Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the February 5th, 2015 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. I would remind folks that if you have electronic devices, this includes legislators, please silence them for the meeting, and that we have emergency exits. They're in the back of the room to my right and to the front of the room to my left. If there should be a fire, please don't use the elevator. If folks are interested in speaking on privilege of the floor, I ask that they fill out the blue cards from the back and hand them up. Would you stand with me and recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, please? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk has asked to be excused. Mr. Dennis?
I'm here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna? Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein? Mr. Lane?
Here.
11 members present.
We have a quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
There will not need to be an executive session tonight. We'll move right then to privilege of the floor for the public. Do we have any blue cards? We don't seem to have any. Anyone want to speak tonight? I guess not. Then we'll move second to the privilege of the floor for municipal officials. Don't think we have any. After that, we move to privilege of the floor for legislators. I do see some legislators out there, so would someone like to speak? Martha Robertson.
Well, I guess maybe I'll start off on the NYSAC conference that a few of us went to this week, New York State Association of Counties, and we got a nice fat package of resolutions that include the Airbnb resolution that Tompkins County passed and sent to NYSAC. It includes a resolution that Dan might want to talk about rural transportation as well. We did hear from Comptroller DiNapoli and Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, but no legislative representatives seemed to have time for us. I wonder where they were. and we did have a representative of the governor's office, not the budget director as scheduled, but a deputy of some level, budget person, who came and did a presentation on the governor's budget. And I would say it was mostly information that we'd heard before. I'm not sure what he heard was anything he'd heard before, because he got a real earful from counties about mandates, about that, this gimmick about the circuit breaker, which they're not calling a circuit breaker. The governor calls it an income tax relief, right? Income tax credit, okay. And as Joe and Peter have discussed before, there are 100 different ways, there are loopholes in this. I think the room was unanimous in believing this was silly. The really way to reduce property taxes is to take over the mandate. So I think we had a sense early on that NYSAC staff might be kind of reluctant to keep talking about Medicaid, feeling that they were, and everybody who was there, it was, you know, Will and Joe and Mike and Dan and Ed was there also. Please jump in with, you know, if I have this wrong, but NYSAC leadership seemed to be reluctant to keep beating the Medicaid drum. I think they heard from those of us in attendance that we we can't stop that story. We need to keep talking about the mandate that 49 other states don't require of counties. Otherwise, you know, it'll go away. We'll never win that battle, and that we need to keep talking about it. So that's just one piece. I would just mention also that while in Tompkins County, you can't go a day without having a conversation about energy in some form. There was only one workshop out of 2.5 days that had anything to do with energy, and it was about the oil trains in Albany. And I think we need to change that. I'll make a suggestion to Steve Aquario. I'll send an email when the dust settles. That I hope that the fall conference, that they will do. There's so much going on, so many opportunities coming out now that counties ought to know about. And so I'll ask them to put more of that on the agenda. But I thought that was one big difference between our life and the rest of the states.
Thank you. Others? Mike Sigler.
So I guess everybody was invited to this presentation today by one of the governor's people. It was up at IC. It was good. It was short. But it was basically there just to give out the governor's 2015 opportunity agenda. A lot of you probably already know what's in that. Of course, the property tax, you know, they were talking about how it was frozen and then how now this year they're planning to cut that. I, of course, spoke on all of your behalfs and said, you know, mandates are going to be – I'm not really sure how you're going to do that unless you relieve mandates. So kind of dovetails off of what you said. And I said, really, if you even just took over Medicaid, we'd be good. So I don't know. It was a good meeting. Got to see Peter's wife, and you know, that's about it. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? Everyone's tired from the snow and the cold. I can see that. I'll speak a little bit more about NYSAC on my report. Well, that. Oh, I'm sorry, Jim Dennis.
I can't let this go by. I'm only here so I don't get fined.
Yes, sir.
That's it.
Well, we did watch the game too, even though we went up to Albany in time to actually to beat the storm. But conveniently, that was got us there before the game on Sunday.
We'll go to. I'm sorry, Will. Get your hands up there so I can see you.
I'm sorry. I note that a member of the public has come out as filling out a blue card. I didn't know if we might indulge somebody with this.
I don't see a problem with that. If the board, the rest of the legislature would like to do that. So we do ask anyone who wants to speak on privilege of the floor for the public to fill out one of our blue cards and agree following rules. I agree to a 3-minute time limit. I agree not to raise my voice. I agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. I agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, I agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. I agree that if I cause a disruption and am asked to leave, I will leave the chambers. And I now have a blue card. Joanne Cipolla-Dennis, would you like to speak with us? There is a 3-minute limit, and it'll be – it's not up.
Are we on?
We'll let you know.
Thank you. Good evening. Joanne Cipolla-Dennis, town of Dryden. So I wanted to let you know that there have been quite a few meetings with attorneys who are well-versed in eminent domain law with the residents of West Dryden Road, where I live. Some of the things that were not disclosed in the town Dryden meeting where NYSIC came a few weeks ago was that all the liability remains with the landowner, and even though eminent domain is imposed, they will be responsible for anything that happens through construction and while that pipeline is in service. NYSEG is not responsible for those. Bob Pass and David Bovey, who are NYSEG representatives, told me that it is the taxpayers of Tompkins County, specifically Dryden or Lansing, depending on when, where the compromise of the pipeline would be. They would be responsible for first response, the expenses to them, and all the cleanup costs. That's you, all of you. When I came here in 2007, I bought 33 acres of pristine property right behind the airport, and I intended to develop that with homes sustainable like mine are that don't actually have a utility bill. My utility bills are actually about $50 a month in the winter only. They're actually free in the summer. I would like to build those houses, but I still have not invested about $3 million in that property because of fracking. When the ban was gotten in Dryden, I began to plan those homes again, which are single-family homes that would obviously pay taxes. Dryden needs that. We need single-family homes here. We need low energy bills here. That's why people can't live here that work here, because they can't afford it. If that pipeline goes through my house, I will be handing the keys to the town of Dryden, and I'm not going to be paying a mortgage on a house that I can't live in. I'm not going to risk my health, my wife's health, and be responsible for a multinational corporation's nastiness. I'm not going to do it. Lansing needs a tax base. They can find it in other ways. They have brilliant people in Lansing. The Bensons are actually very brilliant people who could provide energy for the town of Lansing via biofuels for their entire school if they wanted to. People are not talking to each other. We have very brilliant people here who are ready to do the right thing. And because some people just don't want to believe the facts, they run around and promote natural gas, the very thing that's killing us. The very thing that's killing us. I'm not going to risk my life, my wife's life, my neighbor's life, planting a pipeline near my house. It's not going on my land. It's not going on my neighbor's land. And it's not going through the town of Dryden. Mr. Ziegler, if you want natural gas, put it in your own house. Risk your own life. Risk your wife's life. Risk your family's life. Do not risk mine. Secondly, Mr. Lansing, sir, sheriff, I know you're watching. Seems like you should come face the music. I want you to
conclude.
Thank you. I want you to hand in your badge and your gun to the undersheriff. You are a public risk. You are risking people's health by what you are choosing to do. The incident at Katy Road is your fault. That man's death is your fault and your doing. Secondly, he's the second man to die in a year under Sheriff Lansing's command. Mr. Yavitz died 12 hours after he was remanded to Tompkins County Jail. Why? We should not be putting people who are under the influence in jail. They should go to the hospital. They should be stabilized. And then, if that is their sentence, they should be taken from the hospital to be remanded for duty to go to jail to serve their sentence. Thank you.
Anyone else wants to speak tonight here? Okay. The next thing on the agenda will be turning to Paula Younger for the annual teach-in here. We're going to learn about our core compliance, and we're going to get certified.
Screens down.
We'll suspend long enough to put the screens down.
Thank you.
Paula, when you're ready. Paula Younger is our Deputy County Administrator for the folks at home.
Good evening, everyone. We planned this so that Ed and I could do our presentations behind each other, and then we closed it down earlier, and the computer completely shut down, so it just took us a few minutes. So thank you very much for this opportunity to provide you with an update on our compliance program activities for the operating year of 2014. You do have a number of items that are in front
of
you.
Excuse me, Paula, can you point the microphone just a little more toward you? That's better. Thank you.
You do have a number of items that are in front of you to support tonight's presentation. One, of course, is a handout of the PowerPoint you'll be receiving this evening, so please feel free to use that to take notes as need be. You also have a copy of our 2014 year-end report, which I'll give you some highlights of that during the presentation. You also have an example of our fact sheet series, and I'll also speak to that, but that is a new addition to our series that we developed in 2014. And most importantly, you have an attestation form. As a result of this presentation, this also satisfies your annual compliance training. So the forms have been completed. All you need to do is sign on the dotted line where the colorful sticker is. And then if you just pass them forward at the end of the presentation between Ms. Robertson and our Deputy County Attorney, Mr. Troy, I will pick up those signed forms. Okay. Tonight's presentation, I will give you just a brief background about why we have a compliance program in place. Then give you a review of our program and the eight elements of an effective compliance program as required by the Office of the Inspector General. We will look at some of the program documentation so that you know exactly what we have in place. So at any time, if we're ever asked, ever audited, or whatever, you know exactly where our information is with regard to our program. Once again, the highlights of our year in progress report and give you a glimpse of what our compliance committee has in store for 2015. Certainly, if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them this evening, but you know you can always drop by and visit me in the penthouse of the old jail building, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions you have. So what is a compliance program? Well, it's something that organizations do internally, and the whole idea is to have a framework, a methodology for identifying and reducing risk and for ensuring that all of our policies and procedures that we have in place adhere to those requirements set by law and by the various regulatory authorities to whom we are accountable. So what's the benefit of a compliance program? Most people think of compliance automatically when they hear the word as it automatically being a headache, but actually it's put in place so maybe you don't have as many. But it helps ensure that leadership, employees, operational structures, policies and practices all work in harmony to manage risk. It provides a standard for reducing the likelihood of improper or unethical conduct. Once again, it helps to encourage employees, train them on how to identify risk and report potential problems. And, of course, that obviously improves the ability to quickly and accurately respond to any compliance concerns. And as I said before, it is a proactive approach to problem solving and hopefully reducing the waste of time, the waste of money, and minimizing heartache. So why the emphasis on compliance? When we think of ourselves as government, all we do is follow what the law tells us to do. So compliance should come to us naturally. It's not really new, but how we demonstrate accountability to what regulatory authorities require us to do is very new. They have expanded regulations. A good example of that is HIPAA, which now has been expanded a couple of years ago to include all electronic handling of protected health information. That kind of expanded rule puts more responsibility on us to demonstrate accountability. Obviously, changes in economics call for a greater emphasis on managing risk and controlling waste, fraud, and abuse. There is the increased need for transparency in how we manage our daily operations, how we manage our data, how we report on things that we do. And then, of course, regulatory authorities are passing on these monitoring functions to localities. So they don't do it. We have to monitor ourselves, but we have to definitely demonstrate that we're doing that on a regular basis. Our program, we began development in February 2011, adopted by resolution later on that year in August. Our vision is to sustain a strong and consistent culture of compliance. And, of course, we do this through a proactive countywide agenda with an emphasis on improving our monitoring systems and our internal controls, mitigating risk, and, once again, demonstrating transparency. Our guiding principles, we work with integrity. We hold ourselves accountable and focus on results. We invest in learning and knowledge sharing, and that, of course, means that we are investing in our employees and their confidence, because when it comes to compliance, employees can be our greatest asset, but if they're not properly trained, properly informed, they can also be the greatest liability. Our stakeholders, then, are really the entire organization. The county administrator is the lead person of our compliance program. He appoints the compliance officer and the members of the compliance committee. You, as our legislature, you provide the rules, the guidelines for us. Obviously, our employees, our departments, our regulatory authorities, and the ultimate stakeholder is the community we serve. The eight elements of our compliance program, they include written policies and procedures. One that we emphasize the most is our whistleblower policy. That's a policy that we are required to have on the books that says if there's a person internally, an employee, or anyone externally, a member of the community that has a concern where they feel there is an issue of waste, fraud, or abuse on our part, they can report it. Without retaliation. We have documented disciplinary procedures. Obviously, we do staff training every year, and we train our governing boards. We have routine identification of compliance risk areas, and this is underscored in the new regulations of HIPAA. We have steps for corrective action. We have confidential reporting. And then, as I mentioned, you have a compliance officer, which is me, and our compliance committee, which includes our county attorney, our director of finance, the commissioner of personnel, the commissioner of social services, commissioner of mental health, our director of public health, our director of information technology services, and new to our compliance committee in 2014 is our director of human rights and a newly appointed healthcare security and privacy officer, once again because of the expanded regulations of HIPAA. So our compliance program documentation, these are sort of the infrastructure pieces, if you will, of our program. We do have a comprehensive compliance program document. I'm going to show you where to find that in just a minute. But it spells out, soup to nuts, all of the things that I have expressed to you thus far in this presentation. We also include as a part of our compliance program documentation the Code of Ethics, our administrative policy manual, our fact sheet series, of course, our training, our year-end reports, and then all of this which can be found on our county webpage. And what I'm going to do here, just for a second, because we practice this in setting it up, is just to give you a glimpse. When you go to our county homepage and you cursor all the way down to the bottom, to the right, you'll see a little checkmark area, and that's where you go to access all the information with regard to our compliance program. I'm going to tap on that just a bit. As you see, there's an opening page there. It gives the general philosophy of our program. You have links, quick links, immediately to the left, which is a link to the Comprehensive Compliance Program document. I will tell you, that's a 40-some page odd document. It's a PDF file. I am not going to click on that tonight, but I wanted to let you know where to find that. You have a direct link to our County Code of Ethics. You have a direct link to the year-end report, which is the document that you have in front of you, and we highlight our newest fact sheet. If you cursor down a little bit on the page, you will see other ways of accessing other documentation in addition to the things I've pointed out. All of our previous year-end reports are there, so you can actually see the progress that we've made since we established the program in 2011. There's a message from county leadership, information about our compliance committee, and if you recall, I mentioned our whistleblower policy. We do have to publicize a hotline so that if anybody that has concern, once again, a waste, fraud, and abuse, they can contact us. This is a toll-free number. It is a confidential line. Or if they'd like, they can send me a note, and there's my address and where they can send that information. If you go all the way down to the bottom of that page, we do highlight, once again, our whistleblower policy. We also highlight our exclusion screening policy, which basically says to all persons that we're doing contract work with, all of the companies, we do have to screen them to ensure that they haven't been put on a government list for fraudulent activity. If, in fact, we found to be contracting with these entities, but we haven't checked against an exclusion screening list, that could set us up for a possible fine. The other thing that you can find when you click on the very bottom of our compliance webpage is direct access to our county administrative manual. And if it doesn't come up, that's all right. We'll just move back to the presentation. But that's another way and a quicker way for our employees to have a glimpse of all of our policies. And we actually do have a section outlined when you get to the online compliance, the online administrative manual. As I'll cursor down, if you look to the left, there are several sections of our manual, everything from employment policies to general information to fiscal policies to risk management to information technology. It's all there. And then we also have a section, Section 11, which is totally dedicated to compliance. So this is just to give you a sense of all of the documentation we have available for the public to see. And once again, if you're ever asked or ever audited, you can certainly send them to our compliance page. We'll finish up with our presentation. I mentioned that what you have in front of you is the 2014 year-end compliance report. The first item, I love to say, it is informative reading. We are a busy group, our compliance committee. We only meet four times a year, but we have done a lot of work this past year. So I would just encourage you when you have a few minutes to read it. It does serve as our work plan. It demonstrates our program responsiveness, both to the employees we serve as well as to the public we serve and our regulatory authorities. The format is the same. We always offer you a year at a glance. That's Section 1. We give you highlights of key accomplishments, Section 2. Any issues or opportunities, Section 3. And then finally, what you can expect in the coming year. So what did we do in 2014? Well, we continued our IT policy planning and review. You actually passed the first policy in 2014, our acceptable use policy, which serves as a foundation for other IT policies that will come down the pike this year. You also approved our breach response policy. We recommended strategies for staff training on IT policies. We're still going to be discussing that more in 2015, looking at a more comprehensive approach to how we provide what we call required training or training that we feel that all staff should be required to take and try to include compliance training in that list of topics. We recommend and actually put in place a security risk analysis process, which is required by HIPAA, and that is detailed in your year-end report on the process that we are currently using. Related to HIPAA, we produced a fact sheet on handling private and protected health information, and I'm providing you with a sample of our fact sheet that you have there, a paper copy. By the way, our fact sheet series, we have a rule. It should not exceed 2 pages, copy both sides. It should be easy reading, a lot of white space and a lot of bullets. So we try to take a topic that we think that's really important, and we try to give the basics, the most salient points, and offer that in a fact sheet, and encourage department heads and supervisors to use that as a part of their training to their staff. And then we updated the compliance program document, keeping in mind that our program was established in 2011. We hadn't really done any updates to the compliance document since then. So we changed a little bit of the look and feel, updated it according to some of the rules that it changed. It has all of the information with regard to our breach response protocol and our forms. And also, as if you recall, we also updated our limited English proficiency protocol, and that is also included in our compliance program document. So what to expect in 2015? We're going to continue, obviously, to offer training opportunities to staff, but we're really putting an emphasis on risk prevention and data protection. That, of course, dovetails with the next item there, which is policy review and development as we continue the work on the IT policies and HIPAA policies. But what we also want to do is look at some of our existing policies with regard to how we give guidance on managing risk and protecting data, and look for opportunities to update them, as well as look at our overall amendment process to try to keep that as user-friendly as possible. And then finally, in 2012, we did an internal risk assessment, which is, once again, one of the 8 elements of an effective compliance program. We haven't done a risk assessment since then. One of the things to make sure that your program is doing what it's supposed to do is actually test that. And so we need to reach back out to our departments, looking at the survey data that we gathered back in 2012, look at a way of redesigning that. We also want to take into account some of the information that we might be able to glean from the upcoming workplace climate survey, and then determine how we create a better risk assessment tool that's easy for our departments to use. So that's what we have on tap for 2015. This concludes the presentation and your annual compliance training. Certainly, if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them. But I will encourage you right away to look for that little colored arrow on your, sign that for me and pass it forward, and I'll pick it up from Bill and Martha.
Questions? Martha Robertson, then Will Burbank.
Thank you very much, Paul. This is very comprehensive. It's great. The County Compliance Committee, you said we have a new healthcare security and privacy officer?
Yes.
Is that?
Karen Gonta.
In the health department?
No, actually, Karen sits in our ITS department because most of her work is the data protection piece with regard to protected health information, and that's a requirement under the expanded HIPAA omnibus rule that deals with electronic health information.
Okay, so we didn't hire a new person.
No.
Assigned her. Okay,
no.
So maybe she could help out. What's that insurance company today that was announced at eight yeah. million records or something?
Anthem.
What?
Anthem.
Anthem. They might need this. Thank you.
Will?
Thank you, Paul. Can you talk just a little more about the whistleblower process? If somebody calls that 800 number, that's
877 number.
You know, what happens?
Well, that call actually gets recorded. into a WAVE file, because that's a part of how we have to track those calls. We do have a written protocol on how we handle all of the whistleblower complaints. But basically, all of those calls come into me. I review them. I have to make a determination on whether or not we're actually talking about fraud or abuse, or I guess sort of luckily I haven't had those concerns. But I have had concerns where we have citizens reporting on other citizens. So in that case, you know, there's times I've had to refer some things to our sheriff's department, for example. Sometimes, you know, you have folks that are just looking to vent, but they don't really have a true issue of fraud. But we do record them all. We do have a committee which includes our county attorney that helps us with our internal investigation if we need to do that. And then we also have to write up a report on what we did and what the resolution was.
So the one piece of that, I'm curious in terms of waste, nobody's in favor of waste or whatever, would that ever come to the attention of the legislature? How would that happen if we identified something in our systems that are truly...
Well, the only thing I can say is, I mean, it would have to be done on a case-by-case basis, but certainly if it was a true true concern with an employee, we'd probably have to discuss it in executive session. We would look to follow our disciplinary policies that are already established. But like I said, I would have to look at that actual case.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Julie?
On our handout, page 4, in talking us through it, you mentioned there's, on the website, there's an administrative manual. Earlier, you had mentioned an administrative policy manual. Are those the same thing?
Yes.
So it should probably be called the same thing both places. That's all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Paula, thank you for digesting a very complicated topic down to some understandable slides and teaching us about it as we do each year.
Thank you.
And please convey our thanks to the Compliance Committee for the time they spend on these efforts, because that's really important work for our county.
It is. Thank you. I will.
We have another presentation tonight, so we'll leave the screens down. Ed Marks, our Commissioner of Planning, is going to talk to us about the proposed comprehensive plan for our county.
Thank you, Mike. Just pull up. You're going to be PowerPointed to death here tonight, I'm afraid, but sorry about that.
Neither.
Okay. All right. As you may be aware, at your next meeting, the public hearing on the 2015 update of the County Comprehensive Plan will be held. And so I thought it would be a good idea to just give you a little bit of overview of what's in the plan tonight and prepare you for what you might be hearing in a couple of weeks. First of all, we do have a county comprehensive plan. It exists. It's in effect. It was passed in 2004 and amended in 2008 with the energy and greenhouse gas emissions section. So that's what it looks like. You hopefully have all seen that or remember seeing it. But this, over the last couple of years, we've been reviewing that plan, going out to the public in a number of different ways to get ideas on what current issues in the community are, what concerns are, and have come up with a new plan that looks like this. It's on our website. It's called the 2015 Comprehensive Plan, and that's the plan that will be the subject of the hearing. You have a link to that, and I'd encourage you all to take a look at that in detail. It's fairly, as it's called a comprehensive plan, and this is quite comprehensive plan. There's quite comprehensive, a lot of detail in there, and I encourage you all to look at it. But tonight I'd like to focus primarily on the principles and policies, and specifically the policies, because when you adopt the plan, that's really the meat of what you're adopting as a legislature. You're saying these policies are the policies of the county. The plan is broken down into topic areas. In each topic area, we talk about what the current kind of snapshot of existing conditions in the county. We talk about what are issues and opportunities that we have identified through this two-year process of outreach and talk discussion with the public and with stakeholders of different sorts. And then we talk about what actions the community may already be taking or planning to take. And what the county's role in those actions are. So in the plan for 2015, we're continuing to have sections on the economy, housing, transportation, and all the other issues you see there, but we've added some for this year. Climate change adaptation is in the plan for the first time as an issue, and we've kind of revised the way we've looked at communities and created a section called Healthy Communities, which kind of reflects national and state trends in trying to look at communities from a health perspective, and particularly the way the built environment affects that. The plan has three what we call overarching principles that apply throughout the plan, and one of those is new, the sustainability principle. The other two principles were reflected in the prior plan, regional cooperation and fiscal responsibility. The economy principles throughout the plan are sort of vision statements in a way. They're kind of aspirational, what we think the community should be. And this is, again, based on a lot of dialogue with the community, with different groups that we discussed with as we created the plan. And then the policies. Again, many of the policies in the plan reflect restatements or slightly modified statements of policies that were in the existing plan. But the ones that are highlighted in the darker text there are essentially new concepts or substantially modified concepts from what was in the existing plan. So we talk about diversification of the economy and working with economic development agencies, institutions of higher education to accomplish that. There's a sense that we shouldn't be so dependent on one major industry as we are for the long term, and continued efforts for diversification are important. Promotion of innovation, technology transfer, and entrepreneurship basically is another concept that was somewhat in the existing plan, but it's really more emphasized more strongly in this current plan draft. And these are still on the economy, quality of life measures that enhance local business climate, providing opportunities to all residents to develop skills to obtain high quality employment. That's a new concept in the plan that wasn't in the prior plan. And then ensuring that the benefits and costs of economic development incentives are distributed equitably, and it's a transparent process for awarding those kinds of incentives. Housing, a place where housing is affordable, safe, energy efficient, and appealing. It's hopefully some of those things now, but for a lot of people, it isn't all of those things. Under policies, again, we have several of the policies that were in the existing plan, but we have some new concepts in the plan this time. One, the first darker policy there, is to support housing whose total costs, including utilities and transportation, are affordable. Before we talked about affordability, we're realizing that if a house may on its face be affordable, but it's located someplace where the individual living there has a very expensive commute, and or is not energy efficient and have high utility bills, that affordability may not be real. So those are important factors. Promoting energy efficient housing, both in terms of contributing to that affordability, but also meeting our goals for energy efficiency in the community. Providing housing options for an aging population. We're seeing that to be more and more of a concern. We know our demographics suggest that the number of folks over 65 is increasing and will increase dramatically in the next decade. And so the needs of housing for an aging population may be different, and we need to pay attention to that. And then improving the existing housing stock, it came up and as we were talking with people in the community this time around that there are many problems with quality of existing housing. So not only do we need new housing, but the existing housing stock also needs improvement. Transportation, we're looking for choices that people would have that are efficient, affordable, and healthy. Policies that are new or modified significantly are looking at maintaining and improving critical elements of transportation network. Transportation funding has been falling and lagging behind needs for many years now. There isn't any expectation it's going to improve dramatically in the future. We hope that it'll improve some, but difficult choices have to be made as to priorities. So understanding which elements of our infrastructure are the most critical to supporting the integrity of the community and its safety and its economy are important. Reducing fossil fuel use, that's reflected for the first time under the transportation section, that we realize that in order to meet our energy needs in the future, we'll have to have a transportation system that is less fossil fuel intensive. And then shifting travel away from drive alone to many different other alternatives is going to be an important part of reducing the energy use, and it'll also help reduce congestion. Other transportation policies that we got some feedback on that are new, considering the needs of the populations that are challenged by transportation when developing systems and alternatives, folks that don't have ready access to all modes for a number of different reasons, whether they be economic, physical impairment, or other reasons. Under natural resources, again, some new concepts that have come into the plan this time. We again, reflecting the climate change issue and the effect those may have on species and ecosystems, and also the fact that we're seeing new invasive organisms, not necessarily related to climate change, but often introduced from foreign locations that are now affecting our forests in particular. Promoting best management practices and improving access to outdoor recreation opportunities are some new policies. Under water resources, we are continuing mostly what was in the existing plan. We do talk more specifically about protecting aquifers in this plan with the policy to try to limit development within those groundwater recharge areas. As you know, we've been for many years now working with municipalities to help better define aquifers, their resource, and the areas that are contributing to their recharge. And now as we have that information, we want to make sure that those areas are protected from contamination. Under energy and greenhouse gas emissions, we have a new principle statement here that's somewhat different, where we talk about making sure we meet community energy needs without contributing additional greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And under policies, again, the energy and greenhouse gas emissions element was added in 2008, so those were still pretty current, but we do talk about the opportunity for carbon capture. That's something we understood better after doing the Southern Tier Cleaner Greener Plan, that there's a real opportunity in our forests and also in our wetlands and soils to capture and store carbon in a way that contributes to reducing climate change. We also have adaptation in the plan for the first time, and the principle is that we should be prepared, basically, for what impacts may come with changes that come with climate change. So policies, these are all new. One is paying even more attention to floodways and floodplains. As we know, we're expecting more intense storms with climate change. We've seen examples regionally of 100-year-plus floods happening within 5 or 10 years of one another. And so we need to be particularly paying attention to floodplains to reduce damage from potential floods. Improving connectivity over the open space system, we understand that species may need to have the mobility to move through the landscape to respond to climate change. And so if we don't have connected ecosystems, if they're fragmented, that won't be possible. Promoting adaptations that will lessen impacts on the local economy. A lot of that has to do with potential impacts on agriculture. Encourage actions that protect vulnerable populations. We know that the elderly, for example, are less able to cope with heat waves than other parts of the population. People that live in low-lying areas in particular are also potentially vulnerable. And then preparing the community for recovery in the event of disaster. We have learned from experiences elsewhere in the country that communities who are well prepared in advance, not just for the response, the immediately 3 months after a disaster, but the 3 years after, that have a recovery plan in place, actually can advance the pace at which the community gets back to normal by up to 3 years over a community that's not, doesn't have that pre-planning in place. Then, as I mentioned earlier, we're talking about this concept of healthy communities, that Thomas County should be a place where the built environment promotes healthy, safe, and active lifestyles. We had some elements of that in the existing plan, but we talk more about the countywide trail network, providing improved accessibility, again, for folks that have some level of impairment. Building with accessibility in mind is important. Promoting those facilities and activities that give people opportunities, but for both social interaction and physical activity. Those have both been found to be extremely important for folks' overall health and both mental, social, physical. And then discouraging land uses that actually threaten community health and safety. Development patterns was reflected in the earlier plan. Based on feedback we got in the planning process, some new policies include encouraging municipalities to protect rural character by limiting sprawl and supporting land use policies and public infrastructure improvements to encourage private investment in the development focus areas, those urban, village, and other community centers. So that is the overview of the policies. Again, I would encourage you to take a look at that. We also have in the plan 28 action items, some of which are ongoing activities. They're all on the little handout that's in your red folders. But some of the ones I just wanted to highlight briefly are some of the new initiatives that are coming out of the plan. One is to develop what we're calling an energy focus area strategy. Otherwise, look at areas of the county that are particularly important for our economy, for our health, and making sure that the energy infrastructure in those areas is sufficient to support continued economic activity and growth. We have learned recently that some of these deficiencies have kind of crept up on us without a lot of forewarning, and we want to get ahead of the game, understanding better by working with NYSEG, working with TCID to try to together figure out where we may need to be encouraging investment in our infrastructure. Better define housing needs of our human service agency clients. That includes many departments of the county, social services, youth, aging, mental health. They all have been increasingly seeing that their people that they serve have housing needs and problems in this community, and we need to better understand that and better respond to it. But first step is to understand it better. Identifying critical highway infrastructure, as I mentioned, the policy about, you know, being understanding what's most important for the community in terms of our infrastructure. Developing an integrated green infrastructure program. We, in the past, have talked about protecting streams and protecting wetlands. These are all connected, and increasingly across the country, the concept of green infrastructure, protecting and natural systems for the valuable services they provide, is much less expensive over the long run than to try to create new constructed systems to do the same thing. And so taking a holistic look at our stream corridor program, wetlands protection efforts, aquifer protection efforts, and start to understand that as a part of an integrated system that provides many community benefits. Developing tools to encourage widespread deployment of renewable energy systems. One simple example, through the Solar Tompkins program, we've come to understand what characteristics of a building make it suitable or unsuitable for putting in solar PV or solar thermal systems. New development can learn from that and hopefully be encouraged to develop in a way that can easily accommodate that infrastructure if it's not put in even at the time of construction. Preparing a community disaster recovery plan, I mentioned that earlier. We will be working over the next 2 years to start the process of developing a recovery plan. That may mean putting in place certain understandings of how we would act and respond under certain conditions. And developing a healthy community strategy, working with the county health department and others in the community, how can we do proactively put into place systems that will encourage and result in a healthier overall community. So that's a very quick overview. Again, I encourage everyone to dig in a bit to the thicker document. It's on our website. We can provide you with hard copies if you'd like. And you'll be hearing from the public on the 17th regarding their comment at the public hearing.
Questions for Ed? Martha Robertson.
This is fantastic. Really tremendous amount of work, and it's really nice to see the sort of evolution of it. I see you've added so many, you know, number of principles and policies. Have you taken anything away?
Nothing has disappeared completely. We took and modified the structure of the plan in some cases. We had a section called efficient use of public funds in the prior plan. That's been kind of morphed into this overall fiscal responsibility principle that's more overarching than a separate section. Many of the things that were in there have been accomplished, including, I think at that time, relocation of the health department and some other basically things like what we're sitting in here today, the building issues that hadn't been resolved. Some, a lot of those have been resolved. And so it's really more of an overarching principle that carries through the plan. We restructured what we called strong communities and centers of development into development patterns and healthy communities, and slightly reorganized in ways that are pretty a little more current with the way other governments are talking about these issues now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks to all your staff.
It was definitely a team effort all the way.
Ed, I had a couple questions, but I'll take Kathy first because I just saw her hand.
Okay. I'm in awe. It's a terrific plan. I know there'll be a lot of discussion of it, and I just want to ask. I saw on the page under new initiatives, it talked about energy focus areas strategy, and you alluded to some areas where our infrastructure hasn't kept up with the need, and it sort of caught us by surprise. Can you give me a couple of examples of those so that I can start thinking about that?
Sure. Well, we all know about the natural gas situation out by the airport area. That was not something that people realized was coming. If we had known 5 years ago that there might be an issue, we would have had a lot more time to consider alternative responses to that issue. Similarly, we're finding, although overall capacity in the city seems to be pretty good, there are localized problems with the infrastructure that's in the ground, whether it be electrical or gas. Those sorts of things, again, if we understand them better, if the utility can work with the community to let us know where there might be issues, we can come up with maybe solutions they wouldn't come up with. So that's what that's really all about, so that we're prepared and we're planning in a way that reflects the reality of what the current infrastructure is.
That's great. That's what I was hoping it was. Can I just ask, you were talking about the involvement of TCAD, which makes me think that there'll also be some involvement with development and developers.
Well, we're going to certainly, you know, primarily we're looking to engage the utility first because they're the hardest nut to crack in terms of getting real accurate information. But we also need to understand what the expectations of development are in these some of these areas, and we have a fair idea where the development might want to be happening and what those some of those needs might be. But we really need to have the utility engaged in that process with us, and that's what we're going to be trying to do with this.
Does TCAD engage with the utility?
They do, but you know, it's all to varying levels of success, and I think we have opportunities now. Things that are going on the state level with utilities, maybe encouraging them to be more engaged with their communities, and that's hopefully an opportunity for this to be successful.
Thanks for that explanation. It's very helpful.
Ed, two things if I could ask, please.
Sure.
One is, should the comprehensive plan have something about workforce development and training? And I'm thinking about when we're saying we want higher level jobs, better pay, and those kinds of things, which we try to develop, shouldn't our plan say we need to figure out how to train the people to be able to take those jobs instead of only having high-paid jobs and low-paid jobs in this county with a lot of people stuck in those part-time entry jobs?
Yeah, I'm quite certain there's some that does address to some degree in the text, but there is one action, and we actually talked with Julia Matic about this, what would be the best thing to reflect in here on workforce, and the concept of on-the-job training to attain skills that can allow you to advance to better-paying positions was the one that they were most focused on in the near term, so we did include that in the list of actions. And the actions in here are, it's a two-year list. It's not the only actions that need to be taken, but it's an action list for the next 2 years. So that's the way it was approached in the plan, but absolutely, workforce is an important part of this.
The other question I had was on one of the action items where you say, identify critical highway infrastructure. Does that assume there is highway infrastructure that is not critical?
Well, I guess it's a matter of definition of the word critical. I think all of our highways are important, but there may be some that need to be maintained to a higher level over time because they are critical, either arteries for our economy, some aspect of the economy would be really undermined if they deteriorated. We might say that bridges are the most, you know, essentially a critical element because they maintain connectivity. That we've seen instances where a bridge gets to the point where it can't be utilized and therefore it causes problems for a particular area of the county. So I don't know that all infrastructure is critical in the way we would be applying it here, but this has been discussed at the MPO. The state says they're doing the same thing at the state level, saying that certain elements with limited resources, you need to know where you absolutely need to make sure that you maintain the investment in that infrastructure to a high level. Not that you don't maintain it, but that you maintain it to a higher level.
Like a classification issue?
Yeah, it could be that. It just could be the level of maintenance.
Jim Dennis.
Nothing, Mike.
Other questions for Ed? Yes, Dave. No, not Dave. That's Peter. I'm sorry, you're behind Dooley.
The hot words that you hear these days is the distribution of wealth. You see them every. There's a big article every day in the newspaper about it. And I wish I knew what you were going to say before. I could have looked up something, but I seem to remember an article that I read someplace, must have been in the Ithaca Journal or one of the other newspapers, that said that Tompkins County has a particularly bad distribution of wealth compared to other counties around this region. Something like that. I was really surprised to hear that, did someone else read that?
Yes, it was a statement made by the mayor in an overall look that he was making.
Okay, yes, that's right.
The
okay.
State of the city.
Thank you. So you didn't. I didn't see that you had fixed that as one of the issues that were important to do.
Well, we do talk about in the text. There are many things that are kind of talked about in the text that don't necessarily get reflected in a policy because it's hard to translate them to a policy of county government in some cases. We talk more about opportunity and an economy where everybody has an opportunity to participate and gain from that participation. When you talk about distribution of wealth, we're not really in a position generally at this level to solve that kind of problem, except by providing opportunity where people can move up through opportunity. And that's really, I think, what the plan tends to focus on in that regard.
Anyone else? Ed, thank you very much. A great, great presentation. I know how much work your department has done on this, and we look forward to hearing from the public on it.
Thank you very much.
For my report, I would just follow up some of the comments that Martha Robertson made earlier. We did send a delegation to the New York Conference of NYSAC. All I want to say is NYSAC, and I'm trying to come up with the acronym, New York Association of Counties. And we do this every year, particularly for this convention that we have, because it's centered around the legislative session of the New York State Legislature. We probably had, over 400 people there at the conference. Our delegation consisted of Martha Robertson and Will Burbank, Dan Klein, and Joe Mariana. Peter, we missed you. I know you were trying to get there, but it didn't work out for you. But never mind. You were there last year, and you can be there next year. We heard from several speakers that Martha mentioned. We attended important workshops. Many of us voiced our opinions about different kinds of things that we had before us. I attended a workshop on maintenance of streams, for example, that some of the work that we had done in Tompkins County after the Hurricane Lee flood that had taken out part of a road was shown and shown as a good example of restoring the floodplain and an important road. We went to the budget presentation from the state, the governor's budget people that talked to us about, among other things, the circuit breaker and the tax cap. We didn't necessarily like everything we heard, and I can't say that it went over really well with the members of the counties that were there. But it was interesting to network with people from across, mostly upstate, about similar issues. I attended, toward the end of the conference, a meeting of chairs and executives of the various counties in which we talked about budget issues and I think, as Martha mentioned, it, although a few people and even the NYSAC leadership seem to be interested in saying, well, should we change our focus this year away from Medicaid unfunded mandate to some of the other unfunded mandates, I think around the room that the feeling was heavily expressed that we need to focus on this giant gorilla in the room, which is the Medicaid unfunded mandate, and that we need to continue what we talked about last year. As we know, we brought forward, thanks to Joe Mariana, his presentation, which became a part of the NYSAC program, that if we could eliminate state mandates that we have to pay here or reduce them, we could reduce real property taxes, forcing us, when they kept talking about it's a stick approach that state government has now, if we could have a reduction of these mandates, we could also reduce property taxes, and that's a much better way of doing it than the tax cap or the 2% that we've tried over the last couple of years. We know that the circuit breaker, that we'll be hearing more and more about, sounds good, and it may be helpful to some people, but never let it be thought that the circuit breaker concept is real property tax relief, because it's not. It doesn't affect your real property taxes directly. It simply gives you a credit on your income taxes that you could then theoretically have more money to spend toward paying your real property taxes. So I've called it smoke and mirrors before. I think it is smoke and mirrors. I think a true circuit breaker program would be a good thing to have, but it can't be tied to the freeze and the cap the way it has been. That's my opinion. Did get to go over to the governor's mansion. I was invited there and had never been to that place before. Several county leaders were there, probably 75, 80 people, and we were spoken to by Governor Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, and they talked a lot about their feeling that they had been turning the upstate economies around from Buffalo to the Hudson Valley. I hope they're right, and we like the optimism, and we'd like to see this happen in upstate New York, in the southern tier, in Tompkins County as well. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say about that. I know Joe's going to talk a little bit on maybe. And let me just give an opportunity to Will or Dan or Joe, if they want to say anything about the conference, now would be a nice time to have you do that. Dan?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I guess I was really struck by an appreciation for the New York State Association of Counties and being a member of that, in that their proximity to the state legislative and budget process is a real asset for us, that we it would be harder for us to understand what's going on to the level of detail and the nuances about the budget and the some of the other governor's initiatives that we heard briefings on. And also to the extent that NYSAC is a lobbying agent for us at the state level, the same idea that we're not as close to the process, we don't know it as well. And particularly this year with the change in leadership in the New York State Assembly, some of the NYSAC people were looking at that as an opportunity to get some things accomplished that maybe weren't able to be accomplished before. And again, that's just something that me here in Tompkins County and most of us wouldn't know about as well or wouldn't understand the subtleties of.
Will?
Thanks, Mike. I too find value both what NYSAC does as an organization. But going to the conference, I found it enormously interesting and helpful just to talk with people from other counties. I was struck by the value differences between some other places and ours. And you know, good people doing good stuff, but coming from a very different perspective, and that's useful. Martha mentioned a reference to the trains carrying oil, and I was in a committee meeting where they were discussed. And this was actually relatively new to me, but apparently it's not just a problem for Albany, but it's literally trains going across the state and increasing in significant numbers and carrying two different types of oil, one that's highly explosive, they're being sort of dubbed bomb trains, basically. If one of these were to derail, it could have an absolutely catastrophic effect on a community. And another type of oil that is, I don't think, currently being carried, but has the potential to be carried, is the oil, the tar sands oil, which you've probably heard about in reference to the debate over the Keystone XL pipeline. But if this were carried in a train and a train were derailed, there is a potential for this oil, which is very, very thick and heavy, essentially getting into aquifers and being impossible to clean. It could literally destroy a community's water supply. And this is should be a concern not only of people in where it's offloaded in Albany, but in many parts of the states. And that was just one example of stuff that I learned that I didn't know. But I thank you for inviting us.
Joe?
I think people have captured it pretty well. I do want to note that both Ed Marks and Jay Franklin were there as presenters, so we were well represented, not only among those who were attending the panels, but also participating in those panels. And my sense is the circuit breaker is very likely to occur with connections to compliance with the tax cap. I just get a sense that the governor is going to win that, although certainly it's going to be a good fight to encourage the states to invest the same amount of money in mandate relief. But again, that's my sense. On the way back, we were talking, and Dan said, how in the world do we explain this to constituents? Because it ain't easy. And, you know, I presented a couple of weeks ago, and it was the kind of the bare bones understanding of the circuit breaker. It is far more complex than that. It's multi-year. It's sliding scale. There's a number of twists and turns in this that I will try to get into more understandable form in a memo or a white paper that I can give to you in the next couple of weeks. So as constituents ask you about this, we'll be better prepared. Certainly we got off to a good start with Peter's chart that he handed out last time, but that's what we'll try to be doing over the next couple of weeks to make this more understandable.
Can I just add, yes, thanks, Ed, and thanks for mentioning that Ed Marks was there and so was Jay Franklin. I believe Pat Buchel was there as well, and there may have been others. So we had a lot of folks from Tompkins County participating in this organization. Jim.
Yes, I want to ask Joe a question. And it may be too early to ballpark this, but practically for the legislature, For us to, or any county government, to fall into this circuit breaker slash whatever we're calling it, income tax credit, what would we have to do at this point? Do you have like three bullet points that
we have to be a tax compliant jurisdiction, which means that we have to keep our levy increases underneath the cap. I believe we also have to achieve that 1% levy savings over that three-year period that's a part of the tax freeze. And the complications come, and I'm not going to get into them tonight, because they get pretty hairy. But we are learning about what happens if others aren't able to hit their targets. I think when I was here 2 weeks ago, I said, I think everybody has to hit their marks. Mm-hmm. It looks like they don't. But at the same time, it's going to be, I live in the town of Ithaca, so I have paid town taxes, county taxes, and city school taxes. It sure looks as if any one of us doesn't stay within our cap. It's very unlikely that we're going to meet that income threshold. So again, that's the kind of stuff I'd like to get to you in a briefing paper of some kind to explain how that works over the number of years that this will be rolled out.
Thank you for that, because it just leads into whatever people are thinking, that when you say, how do you describe it to the constituents, I think that's the goal. They don't want anyone to really understand it, and it comes out from above, and it's left up to us at the local level, and it's just another way of saying to the local elected officials, you guys can't do this, and you don't understand. So it's so amazing.
Julie Kiefer.
Then
Peter Stein.
I had a question. Did the part of their NYSAC's 2015 agenda it still include allowing RTVs on trails?
I don't think so. We looked for that, but I don't believe there was a resolution about that. We've got a big packet, and you can look through it, but I didn't see it.
I will look for it, but I thought
we looked for that and the other issue that you raised regarding the watershed. Peter?
I have a depressed comment. I don't think, you know, it may be more complicated. It may be complicated to understand now, but we'll understand it. And it's not going to be that complicated after we understand it. And we're going to obey it, because the political danger that one will have if you don't obey it is just so much bigger than anything we've seen before. I think we'll be forced. And I'm not worried about the other municipalities, because they'll feel it just as bad as we will. I mean, they'll be forced not to go over the tax cap for the very same reason that we're forced not to do it. So I think it's going to work. And frankly, I think the chance of the state government not passing it are infinitesimal, given what's happened in the assembly. I just don't see a new person having the power to be able to convince the assembly to not accept what the governor wants to do. So I'm very depressed. There's one thing you said that I couldn't imagine being more depressed, but one thing you said that if I understood you right, is not only do we have to stay under the tax cap, but the tax cap itself is going to drop or something like that, that we're going to have less and less as the years go by. We won't be able to increase it even a percent. Is that correct? Did I hear you right?
Not quite. And I'm now explaining my belief, not my knowledge. It's my belief that to be considered a tax cap compliant jurisdiction, we have to stay within that, call it 2% levy limit. And also, as a part of the tax freeze, we have to show that we have taken action to reduce our levy by at least 1% and sustain that 1% reduction for at least 3 years. So this year we're supposed to present a plan that shows how we intend to save 1% of our levy for the next 3 years. And then in the future we're supposed to show that, in fact, we are saving that 1%. I think we have to pass both of those tests. Again, staying within the levy limit and also achieving our cut reduction. It's the second test that I still need to research to make sure I'm correct on that.
So you sort of think that in 20 years that we're going to have to cut our levy by 20% in the same dollars?
I think that's if in fact that test is going to be applied, I haven't heard anything that says that will be. You have to cut 1% every year, because if you cut it for 100 years, it would be at zero. So I haven't heard that. I've heard mostly you have to be tax cap compliant, which means your levy can't grow by more than that. I'd call it 2% cap.
Will, did you have your hand up? Jim?
No, I will under B&A. Okay.
Thank you. Chair's appointments. I talked to you a few meetings ago about my intention to establish a Tompkins County Bicentennial Commemoration Commission. And we're going to set that up. And I'd like to read the charge we're going to give to that group. The year 2017 will mark the 200th anniversary of the creation of Tompkins County by the state of New York. This bicentennial will mark an important milestone in the history of our county and will become the vantage point from which we can look back to the indigenous occupation and to the pioneering settlement and establishment of our county. From the same foothold, we can survey the panorama of our modern county, helping to understand how we arrived at where we are, examining the social, economic, environmental, and political forces that churned over time to bring us here. And from that very same perspective, we can gaze into the future for a glimpse at where we are heading and how we prepare for those inevitable changes that will come just as they have come over the past two centuries. Tompkins County is establishing a bicentennial commemoration commission whose task shall be to inform and educate the people of our county and beyond about its rich history and its role in the health, welfare, and safety of our residents. It will celebrate the diversity of our population and will be inclusive of the contributions of all. It will plan and recommend to the county legislature those events and sponsorships that will serve the serious goal of commemoration and the fun of celebration. The commemoration shall occur in 2017 over the course of the full year. The commission will work to include participation by residents in the towns and villages, as well as the city of our county seat. The commission shall consist of up to 25 members appointed by the chair of the Tompkins County Legislature. It shall be co-chaired by the Tompkins County historian and the chair of the legislature. Initially, the commissioners shall be the following: Carol Kamen, Tompkins County historian; Michael Lane; George Boyer; Ray Wheaton; Joe Mariana; Vivian Rose; John Wirtus; Rod Howe; Leslie McBean Claiborne; Marsha Lynch; Rosemary Tucker; and Susan Curry. Once organized, the commissioners may recommend to the chair of the legislature the appointment of additional commissioners as they deem appropriate to best further the goals of the commission. So I'm appointing that initial group tonight. Let's move to reports. We have a report from the county administrator.
Thanks, Michael. Just a couple of calendar updates, and then I'm going to present the third of three PowerPoints tonight, which makes me feel like I've died and gone to heaven, because you know how I feel about PowerPoints, although I think we're all going to need neck braces by the time we're done here. A couple of just calendar updates. February 9th, next week, we've organized a meeting of all TCOG members, including staff and elected officials from TCOG, to have a session to talk about whether there are opportunities for shared training between all of us. And I know we've talked about this before, but Deb Prado from the county, Shelley Michelle Nunn from the city, and Judy Drake from the town of Ithaca are going to host a meeting. It will be intended to really elicit good ideas about whether we can do some shared trainings. That's February 9th at 3 p.m. It'll be in the Sustainability Center space behind COFA. Leslie, I don't know if you're going to talk about the kickoff of the survey on the 9th. I'll start, and at the end of the agenda, you can remind everybody it kicks off also on February 9th. So the switch goes on the 9th. It stays on through February 20th. We encourage everybody to participate in that, including legislators. So off we go on the workplace climate survey. And last, in terms of calendar, on the 12th, from 2 until 3:30 is the Energize New York workshop. We've talked about this at some length before. This is really the last step in due diligence before it comes to you for enactment of legislation to allow this program that will provide long-term low-interest financing for non-residential properties to make investments in energy conservation and energy technology. This is a real important part of what Ed Marks has been talking about in terms of what we can do in the future to meet the aspirational energy goals that are in the long-term plan. So those are three things that you may want to include on your calendar. We can get the slide going. Ed talked about the future. This is a look back at the recent past at 2014. It's hard for me to believe, this is the seventh one of these that we've done since we began to do a quick look back and ask departments, what do you think were your major accomplishments over the past year? As a preface, I'll note there's nothing here for the legislature, not because the legislature didn't accomplish anything. You accomplished a lot. But these are from county department heads, and the solicitation was to them, again, to list some of their major accomplishments. And this is a compilation. This isn't everything that was submitted, but it does give you kind of a profile of what we've done. There are 29 slides in this packet. The rule of thumb is a minute a slide. I'm going to talk really fast because I don't think you've got a tolerance for a half hour of more slides. So we begin with the airport. You know that we are trying to reverse the trend of declining passenger activities at the airport. So under the leadership of Mike Hall, we have engaged the airlines. We've engaged customers. Our goal is increasing passenger activity. Within the next 3 years, we'd like to be back to where we were at peak levels. We've strengthened internal operations. There have been some organizational improvements there. We started the design of a terminal security improvement. And Ed has been very helpful in making sure that the design includes those green principles. Remember, we had the green master plan for the airport. We want to make sure that those principles are integrated into the terminal security improvement plan. And last and recently, we had a very successful disaster drill at the airport. And this is a little bit of a departure. It used to be only airport staff. A reach out was done to other public safety agencies in town, and it was an excellent coordinated response to a disaster drill at the airport. Assessment continues to hit the gold standard of assessing. 16th consecutive year at assessing at a uniform percent of value. That's where the law says you should be, and again, that's the gold standard. We are there now consistently. They made a lot of assessment changes last year, and not all, in spite of what people may think, not all were increases. There were about 1,100 decreases out of the 7,200 changes that were made last year. Good growth on our tax base, and this is taxable and exempt. 2.2% increase in our overall tax base that lifts it to $11.2 billion. And assessment is really pioneering a lot of productivity-enhancing technology for us, a lot of field technology especially, that has made them much more efficient and effective. Clerk of the Legislature, here again, technology is a major part of what has been accomplished by the clerk. New web-based calendar. Really optimizing the use of the meeting management software and expanding its use to others, and continuing to look for ways to apply that technology and other technologies for the purpose, really, of public engagement. That's what we are all about. My office, you'll notice, needed two slides to get all of our good stuff in there.
Who was the editor?
So you know that Paula has been very much involved with Leslin and WDIC in getting the workplace climate survey process going, and that's about to get underway. We developed, per the new policy, new diversity metrics, and I think all of you now have copies of that to see what kinds of things we're now looking at. We assisted with new policies. Paula just talked about compliance. Breach incident and acceptable use are very much a part of the compliance environment in this county. We did help craft NYSAC's response last year to the property tax freeze. I think we got in front of that well and really shaped the way the statewide organization approached the governor's plan for a tax freeze last year. We conducted two department head searches over the course of 2014. We're also transitioning. A lot of the paper activities that are occurring in the county continue to be automated. The next one's going to be contracts in the bidding system. This is really important and really good. If you work for the county, you know how important it will be to automate those systems. I don't mean if you work for the county. If you were in the kind of the bureaucracy side of the county, that's an important step forward. We assisted with the implementation of the new website, and we presented a budget to you that was within the tax cap and therefore within the parameters that you set without reducing our services. The county clerk, this is really a remarkable success story. Received the third New York State Archive Shared Services grant. We believe in shared services, and we do it. We've now received almost $500,000 in grants over the life of this program. DMV is adapting to new requirements in that operation. This I found really interesting, and a lot of this is the digitization process. Largely Maureen Reynolds, but others in that staff, published 15 articles about what we've done. They gave 8 conference presentations regarding the new records management and digitization, and they've received not only awards but meaningful awards as a result of really groundbreaking work that they've done on digitizing archives and records. County Office of the Aging, they've reached out. They've talked to the community through a number of community-wide planning sessions. I think many of you may have gone to the Senior Housing Expo at IC. great attendance and extremely important feedback that they received from folks in that program. They did a senior housing need and preference survey. They've received grant money that's, we talked about it earlier today in a committee meeting, transition services for Medicaid beneficiaries to help them transition from hospital to home. And all of you are aware of the PERS system that we've had for a long time. We have a new PERS system, tricky transition to a new system and a new approach done very well by COFA. Board of Elections, some new processes to reduce the wait times, to ensure the right to vote. The reporting, election night reporting, I think if you clicked on, you know that it's better than it has been. We've really adapted to the new technology. They've improved access at several of their poll sites, and they've used grant money to do that. And there's more on the way that they're trying to accomplish now through technology. Emergency response, boy, I think this is really important. The new leadership of the 911 Center, we have seen remarkable improvements there, in part because of new leadership and a communication center manager and a professional development coordinator, basically a quality assurance and training person. We are now underway with plans to be accredited at the 911 Center. It's a big leap forward. Lee especially has been remarkably good in getting grant money, $500,000 for a new phone system there that we thought we were going to have to use county money to buy. He found grant money and a very large grant to go interoperable not only within the county but beyond the county to other counties so we can talk to each other. With facilities, you know that we are underway with the Human Services Building expansion. The jail renovation design is done. That will be getting out of the ground very soon. They began the implementation of a three-year, $2.5 million capital maintenance program. So some of the things that we have had to put aside over the past several years, we will now begin to attend to through that program that you've approved. They are very much involved in the workplace violence prevention assessment that involved a very inclusive process. Our employees, our unions, and our department heads in identifying risk areas. Finance, with Rick Snyder at the helm, we've done very well. That AA1 rating, which is almost the gold standard, very few people have it, has been maintained. There was a significant savings by refinancing old debt. Ultimately, when you add it up, $2 million by refinancing old debt, and not an easy process to do that. We financed a number of capital projects. We did them at below market rates. And we have some new software for tax collection, so we're also looking at technology there. From time to time, TC3 and TCAT have reached out to us asking for a little help in balancing cash flow, and we've been there to respond to those requests. And the purchasing operation is within finance, and that's been coordinated on several major projects through them. In the health departments, the Ebola threat emerged this year, and all of you know that our health department quickly assumed a strong leadership role in responding to that threat. The most recent example of that was the countywide drill that I know Peter has talked about before that involved a lot of health agencies in this community. They received an additional five-year grant for a Healthy Neighborhoods program. The WIC breastfeeding initiation rates exceeded 90% for the first time. That far exceeds what is seen in other counties. So those folks are doing well. A grant to support training in a number of local agencies involved in early childhood development. This is kind of a collaborative process. Health coordinated that workplace violence assessment that I said that facilities was also involved in. And, of course, you remember that they were advocates of prohibiting electronic nicotine delivery systems and to encourage pharmacies to stop selling tobacco. Both very much involved the legislature in those discussions. Highway, we got a lot done this year, including some that have been long in coming. Hanshaw Road, basically done. The Forest Home Drive, historic bridge replacement, done, and I think done very well. The Ludlowville Detention Pond, done. Design of the next major stretch, long stretch of Ellis Hollow Road, design is done. That will get started this spring. All told, 34 miles of road work, paving and reconstruction, a fair amount of bridge work that was done by by the highway folks, and federal aid for a couple of intersection safety projects, Pine Tree and Ellis Hollow and Cottington and Birds. And then design work started on four bridges. So capital projects in the future, the design work began on those this year. Human rights, a lot going on in human rights, shared service contract with the city. So the collaborative effort with the city to do the fair housing survey, we were in front of that. You know that human rights was involved in the Department of Justice training that was provided to IPD, but also four of our deputies attended that training. sponsored the first annual What Would MLK Say Today, the poster contest, received 300 entries, organized the Human Rights Day, did a lot in the way of public outreach over the course of this year. In mental health, this is a big one. And it arose during the conversation about alternatives to incarceration. Often when people talk about jail crowding, they say that there is a need to more rapidly respond to folks with mental health issues. Now, this year, we can serve people who walk up. It used to take days to be able to accommodate them when they came to us for help. We've selected a new electronic medical record system. There's a pilot treatment here. We're one of few communities to deal with individuals who are dealing with first episode psychosis. Productivity rose in that department significantly over the course of 2014. And rightly or wrongly, productivity is very much a part of the Medicaid and mental health billing environment that we exist in today. Added some providers for client housing and employment. And personnel, you know that we're at the table with all of our unions. Personnel led those negotiations and is leading those negotiations still because we're still at the table. They coordinated a couple of national searches for department heads. They expanded, and this is important also in terms of our diversity and inclusion goals, they expanded pretest recruitment and preparation to help people get ready for those civil service tests and be interested in taking them. Automation is a theme in a number of these areas. Personnel continues to find ways to optimize technology to make it easier for municipalities and for folks who are interested in applying for county work to do that. Planning, you saw the draft county comprehensive plan, major undertaking by planning this year. Planning was also the central staff support for the old library redevelopment process. They also provided a great deal of support for the Solar Tompkins program, and that program is producing results, and you can see what they are. 400 contracts, 3 megawatts of installed capacity. Worked with municipalities in a hazard mitigation plan, and that is done. Completed the Climate Showcase Community Grant. Here the demonstration proved that they can achieve a 78% reduction in gas emissions compared to a typical house. Over $1 million in grants for home ownership and rehab and assisted with some other projects throughout the county. In probation, this again came out of the Jail Alternatives Task Force. They reintroduced a weekend swap program. So instead of spending time in jail, some inmates were able to do essentially community service on the weekends through this program. A new job readiness program. We're interested in reentry and getting folks prepared for work. So that started this year. They also conducted an active shooters drill for all of their staff. Unfortunately, it's something that we have to think about to the extent that we have planned ahead and done some drilling. We're all better off for that. And they conducted a smart work project to streamline their back office functions. In a similar vein, the sheriff has introduced a new Thinking for a Change program. This is also a reentry initiative for inmates of the jail. They started the Project Lifesaver program, which helps track individuals who have basically wandered and make it easier to find them when they do wander. Very much a participant in the Jail Alternatives Task Force. Not somebody who was defensive about the situation of the jail, but several of the sheriff's staff participated in that in a very constructive way. They also started a drug drop-off bin for the safe disposal of medicines. Social Services is the most humble of our county departments. I had 2 pages. I think they had 3 bullets. But they accomplish well beyond what you can put on a slide. They did receive a Doris Duke Foundation grant, only 1 of 4 communities in the United States to receive that, to look at how we can better help kids who are involved in the family court system. Satellites, we're dipping our toe in satellite offices. We have 2 of them, one in Enfield and 1 in Trumansburg. We operate once a week. Adoptions, 32 were handled or finalized this year, and we still have a number of child protective cases, probably more than any of us really want, so over 1,200 of those cases were handled. Solid waste, you've talked a great deal about the food scrap initiative, so you know that that has gotten off to a very strong start and is very promising in terms of the next wave of things that we would like to accomplish in solid waste. Aries diversion plan, Finger Lakes reuse, you know, is in a new building, and we've forged a partnership between them and Casella Recycling to make sure that we optimize what they can do with reuse. Tremendous attendance at the household hazardous waste. And solid waste is really good about getting into the community, talking to people about what we do that can assist them, what our programs are all about. You can see this is alphabetical, so we're getting close to the end. Workforce investment, the One-Stop Career Center served 2,000 individuals, so the economy is better, but we're still seeing a lot of individuals who are there for our help. We're pretty successful when they come to us. You can see that about almost 1,000 people were placed in jobs with a $30,000, $31,000 average income. A fair amount of training, and a health career expo for high school students to let them know what the opportunities would be in the health sector once they get out of high school. And again, there's a special focus on folks who should get a particular focus. Veterans, low-income people, disconnected populations, individuals with disabilities, and so forth are the focus of our work there. Youth services. Expanded youth employment offerings through a partnership with the Cooperative Extension of Rural Youth Services. As kind of a policy nerd or a metrics nerd, I find this next one important. It's a performance measurement system called results-based accountability that will be used to evaluate agency and service performance, and I think may have applications throughout the county once we really get a good rhythm down. More outreach through a newsletter and a Twitter account. And we're in the market for a new provider of runaway and homeless services. So that's about as fast as I can talk, and it really does short shrift all the accomplishments that occurred over the course of 2014, but I hope this gives you a sense of, you know, the level of activity and the things that we did accomplish over the course of the past year.
That's great. I think that's great.
Thank you, Joe. Questions on that for Joe? Go ahead, Martha.
Yeah, you mentioned that the probation did a smart work.
Yes.
Actually, I know we've gone through a few departments with that process. Is there anybody else kind of in the queue?
As we speak, I don't think there's anybody involved in it right now. I think the last one may have produced the new contracts and bidding software and led to that. I don't think there's any active ones right now. There's money in the 2015 budget, though, for departments that want to use it.
Okay. I think this is really amazing. You know, and I just – something else from NYSAC. They had – I'll put this on the top of the mailboxes. 101 ways counties serve New Yorkers. And, I mean, it's the breadth of what – the variety of what county government does is, as you've shown, is just amazing. Thank you.
Thanks. Will?
Joe, your very last bullet point was news to me. We're in the market for a new provider for runaway services and homeless services.
Our old provider decided not to provide that service anymore.
Okay.
So Amy is in the market for a new provider, and I think is making good progress on that.
All right. Thank you.
And I would say also that trying to help folks understand all of what we do and what a breadth of services you just went through in that 10-minute talk. This was an area of discussion at NYSAC among county officials. How come is county government so little understood when we provide so many services? And maybe we aren't good enough at blowing our own horn. So I think that when we have reviews like you're giving us here, and we think about talking with people out there, we'll have an opportunity to let them know all the services that counties provide for them every day. We're very pleased tonight to have with us our new deputy county attorney, William Troy. Anyone that doesn't know Bill, he's here. Jonathan's brought him in, and he'll be working with John in the future. And I'll turn it over to Bill. Do you have a report for us tonight?
Not really. Jonathan's been away this week. I've avoided unmitigated disaster for the county. But other than that, I really can't report very much. It is nice to see you all, though, and to be here.
We'd like to welcome you to our organization here. Anyone want to grill him?
congressional hearing?
I have a question.
Jim.
I read an article recently that you and Andrew Cuomo were appointed ADAs at the same time in New York City, and I think you've done very well for that. After that,
thank you.
That's an amazing thing.
It was pure chance.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Our director of finance is Rick Snyder.
Good evening. I'd like to share with you the sales tax report. If you turn to page 8 and 9 in your agenda packet, it's available for you to look at. That's pages 8 and 9. This is the last quarter report for 2014. So this is basically how we ended up the year. And that's probably the most memorable type of report to give, because as we branch out and start collecting taxes for the new year, you know that the first few months of every year we're always a little bit behind in sales tax collection. This report begins to show you how our fourth quarter in 2014, how we performed. And so if you go to the sales tax distribution summary, in the top section in the middle where it shows the fourth quarter activity, you can see that the fourth quarter was up 9.3% compared to the fourth quarter of 2013. If you move over and down a little bit to the county section, I want to talk about the year-to-date numbers. These are probably the most important. Your year-to-date tax distribution for the county's portion totaled $34,002,506, and that's compared to $32,466,434 in 2013. And that represents an increase of $1,536,152, or 4.73%. So there in the right-hand margin, in the county section, you can see that our growth or our increase for the year finalized at 4.73%. From a budget perspective, because we are at the end of the year, we should be at 100%, right? But our collections actually came in at 103.6% of our budget. So we were over budget by that amount, 3.6%. The other table that I like to show each quarter on page 9 basically shows a whole lot of years, and with 2014 being presented, the most recent year at the bottom. And you can see there in the second column is the county share of sales taxes. And again, if you look at the fourth quarter, a little over $9 million compared to the fourth quarter for the county last year, that once again shows a great quarter for us, 9.3% increase. I once again went back historically to look at all the other numbers. You can scan it yourself and see that historically this is the highest quarter on record for the county. And that concludes the sales tax report. Mike?
You're batting 1,000 for us, Rick, with this good news. And I would point out that this is particularly good if you look around the state right now. There are a number of counties that sales tax collections are soft for, and they aren't meeting their expectations. So for us to meet it and exceed it is very important for showing our economy is still functioning very well. Peter Stein.
I have a question. I was looking at some numbers here, and they really surprised me. If you look at the total receipts starting from 1997 to the present, you ask, where's the great huge crash in the U.S. economy? It's true that there was one drop here someplace, beyond that, it keeps increasing.
Yeah,
all
between
the way
2008
up.
And 2009, you can see where it shifts into the four quarters. There, you can see 2009 was quite a drop compared to 2008.
That's the only,
other than that, that's
other
the
than
only.
That, it's been that doesn't look like there's any catastrophe if you look at our local sales tax, right?
Yeah, well, you should have had owned a house, Peter. That.
What?
You should have owned a house that went in the tank, and then you wouldn't say that.
what happens, though, Peter, even though some of the sales tax went up, the demand for our services, particularly social services programs,
I understand.
Expanded.
I understand that, but I'm really surprised that there's as much, you know, people were buying things more or less at the same rate for that whole period. It just surprised me when I looked at it.
Martha Robertson.
Well, that's true, but then you look at the next year, and it went up the next year, but it's still below 2008. So it was, you know, slow recovery. Rick, I wanted to know, you said it was we ended the year 6% over budget?
No, we were at 3.6% over budget.
3.6% over budget. And what happened in the fourth quarter? That's crazy. That's great.
Santa Claus was coming to town, and usually November, December are the heavy months. If you remember last year, we pulled out ahead after a few deficit months to meet and exceed our projections. But the same thing happened in this year. You know, most noticeable is the retail sales, but then there's also the energy component. We're one of the counties that sales tax is charged on energy. And so you might see that, you know, whenever it's very, very cold, there's a lot of energy being pumped.
This includes tax on gasoline, right?
Yes.
So that went way down. So
no, tax didn't go down.
What? But if people are paying less than the, you know, whatever the percentage is for each tank, getting less for gasoline. So maybe people really thought, cool, I'll spend it somewhere else. And also on the horizontal chart, it looks like it was fairly well distributed between the city and the towns, too. So.
True.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Was there another hand? Okay. Yeah. Rick, thank you. Are there resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Dooley Kiefer.
Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee met before this legislative meeting. And we have appointments to the Soil and Water Conservation District of two legislators, which we would like added to our agenda for the legislature tonight. That's one thing. And we also passed a resolution dealing with the REV, which is New York State's re-envisioning its energy plan. And that resolution asks that the comment period be extended so that we have time to participate. That also passed PEAC, and I would like that to be added to the agenda. So do I make a motion?
Please.
Do I do them separately or together?
You can do them together.
I'll move to have both of those added to our agenda for tonight.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave. All those in favor of adding the appointments and the resolution to the agenda, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Thank you.
We have some advisory board appointments. Out of Health and Human Services, the Human Rights Commission, we have Victor A. Lopez Carmen. For the Office for the Aging Advisory Committee, Enid Reed, Mary Maynard, Mary Lovelace. The Youth Services Board, Bernice Yarish. The Mental Health Subcommittee, Edward H. Bergman, Jean Poland. The Developmental Disabilities Subcommittee, Elise Schweitzer. Community Mental Health Services Board, Christine Donovan. Substance Abuse Subcommittee, Susan G. Crowell. Board of Health, David George Evelyn. Out of the Public Safety Committee, Family Court Advisory Council, Olivia Armstrong. Out of Planning, Environmental, and Energy Committee, the Soil and Water Conservation District, James Dennis and David McKenna. I believe those are the two we added, weren't they?
Yes, sir.
Out of Health and Human Services, we have a Resolution A, ID 5371, Budget Adjustment, Health Department, WIC Program. Out of Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Resolution B, Acceptance of New York State Homes and Community Renewal Office, Community Renewal Community Development Block Grant, Healthy Homes Rehabilitation Program 2. And I believe those are all of the consent items. Do I have a motion? Motion by Kathy Luz Herrera. Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley Kiefer. All those in favor of those appointments and the resolutions, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Carried unanimously. At 7:30, we'll take 10 minutes. Please come back by we'll take 10 minutes. Come back.
You know, we left.
How big if you were good in physics, okay, to figure out what the pole was. Okay, I'll follow up here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So it had like momentum. It's really kind of.
This also says that the invitation has been extended to the
How's she liking the job at Cornell?
She is licensed.
So you guys get a lot more opportunity to hang out. There is life after.
That's true. That is true.
If someone said to me that today, well, I'm not going to run again, for sure. You know, right after the bicentennial.
Yeah.
when they make us dress up like Davy Crockett, then I can say I'm not running again.
No, it's not much if you're all. Okay, that's good. That's good.
72. Well, you know, I mean, I have to work at it, believe me. I could just as well sit in a chair and watch the rerun.
Which is like how 85% of people your age are doing it. Yeah.
You know, so instead of that, I try to figure out with the Roku, what new show can I watch?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's good. I'm glad you're happy.
Yeah, no, it's been really nice. Yeah, tired as hell.
I mean, your job is. Obviously, keeping you very busy.
Yeah.
Yes. Hi.
Did you ever get
me? No, so I just wrote back to you. The thing is that I have an hospital board meeting on Thursday, and I have a
special budget. Feeling. This cold weather makes us feel that way.
Can we take our seats, please?
So I accommodated that, and so that's why I. So Friday.
Keep finding that money.
Yeah.
I don't think Friday is my list of my birthday. Friday after.
Are we ready to start? We have our standing committee reports and a couple of resolutions, and maybe we can be able to go home at a decent hour tonight on a cold night.
I resign.
We'll start with our and tonight we start with the 2015 committees and the organization. So, Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, our chair is Dave McKenna.
Facilities has not met. We'll meet Monday at 3:30 here, and that's my report.
Questions for Dave? Thank you, Dave. Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson, chair.
Thank you. We put together the agenda today. Karen and I put together the agenda for next Wednesday's meeting, Wednesday at 3:30, February 11th. It's usually going to be the first Monday of every month, but this month we went to the second because of the NYSEC meeting. So look for that agenda next Wednesday, and really looking forward to leading this group.
Questions for Martha? Thank you, Martha. We'll go to Government Operations Committee. Dan Klein is the chair.
Thanks, Mike. The Government Operations Committee in its current incarnation will have its first meeting on Tuesday, February 24th, 3:30 here in the Legislative Chambers.
Questions for Dan? Let's move on. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee. Dooley Kiefer is the chair.
As you all know, we met before this legislative meeting, and I have, I guess, just one resolution, E, that I should bring up.
Would you like to move that, please?
I would. Do I have it in front of me? Of course not. I'm sorry. The other committees went so fast.
It's been...
Thank you. Resolution E, it's got a very long title. It's ID 5400. Resolution addressing renewing the energy vision for New York State, and requesting the New York State Public Service Commission to extend the comment deadline on case 14M0101, the staff straw proposal for Track 1, and for case 14M0224, order instituting the proceeding and soliciting comments. And I move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Let's open it for discussion. Dooley, you want to describe this?
Yes, briefly. The promise of this is very great, that we can have a way to have renewables implemented more quickly than is even happening now. But the commission is interested in a new business model for their utility regulation, who should be the providers, and so forth. And the county first got an official notice from the Public Service Commission on January 20th. The notice was dated January 9th. Why it took until the 20th to get to us, I don't know. Mike Lane received it, and he passed it on to me. And I thought it was appropriate for us to do something. It seemed a very important subject. Then I got a communication from the town of Caroline, which passed a resolution at the beginning of this week asking for an extension because they too saw things happening too fast for public participation. And that's really what this resolution is is doing. It gives you some information about the initiative that the Public Service Commission has undertaken and its two-track approach, one having staff look at how things could happen, what the business model should be, and staff's track one proposals seem very much market-based and rely a lot on the financial sector in the state rather than looking to have it more a public utility approach. So that's one of the things that I think we should look at hard and comment on. Track one is available to review, but the deadline for comments is February 10th, and there's no way that we can have staff or ourselves look at the details and make sensible comments. So I hope you will all support this request for an extension of the deadline for comments.
Questions? Martha?
Julie, I haven't read through, I haven't really gone to the original documents, but what's a straw proposal?
Well, it's like a straw poll, I guess. It's a first crack at their analysis. And it's their analysis of how to approach this market-based way of doing things. I didn't give it that name. I apologize for that name.
Hopefully it's not a straw man proposal.
We normally don't do this, but since you mentioned the town of Caroline had come on board with this, I see town council member Irene Weiser here. If no one has objection, I could ask her to comment on that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hi, Irene Weiser, council member in the town of Caroline. And actually, I think Julie did a perfectly fine answer on what is this straw proposal. This proceeding, I do want to put one little correction. There are two components of the proceeding that are mentioned in this resolution. The Public Service Commission initiated this proceeding back in, I think it was April or May of this past year. And I attended an early public conference that they had about it. It was unbelievably esoteric and very heavily industry dominated. And so it's something that I just, and on this ridiculously fast track procedure, they had already envisioned that they would enact all of the reforming the energy vision by the end of this year. They set up several committees to advise that, you know, were supposedly going to involve public input, but nobody could make those kinds of schedules for meetings except people with industry and within the industry who could be dedicated to that. So anyhow, this has been very fast-tracked. There are now not just two proceedings, but several proceedings that have spun off of this, including one that's on continuing to fund the Green Energy Fund and how that's going to be managed and whether they're going to continue the surcharges on our electric bills or just turn it over to market forces to encourage this development and how this relates to the renewable portfolio standard. Everything is up in the air. It's on the one hand, very thrilling. On the other hand, absolutely overwhelming, and it frankly has not involved any measure of public participation. It was only thanks to the activism of a public interest group that amassed, I think, about 50 sign-ons and spoke directly to the administrative law judge who's handling this, that they were able to say, you got to hit the brakes, you got to involve the public. And so with that, they did then send this notice to municipalities and schedule some public hearings. The notice for the Binghamton public hearing, which is coming up this coming Thursday at Binghamton City Hall, 6 o'clock for public information session, 7 o'clock for public hearing. We were given two weeks' notice on that, 1 month notice for public hearing up in Binghamton and up in Syracuse and in the Albany area in New York City. It's just been kind of crazy and really no time to get up to speed to be able to respond in a meaningful way. And this has substantial significance to municipalities. They're talking about – somewhat good stuff, distributed generation and sort of a mega type of plan for municipalities to enroll residents into a bulk buying thing to then be able to buy power. But, you know, this has tremendous implications for our entire local economy. For anybody who's held out any hopes of local economies also meaning locally controlled or municipally controlled, and this is turning it all over to Wall Street investors or potentially. So a lot to be concerned about, not enough time to give it the kind of review that it warrants. And so,
thank you for coming tonight and providing that information to us. Jim Dennis?
I pass.
Anyone else? Martha?
I've heard renewing and reforming and other R words. And you just, I mean, just said reforming the energy vision. So I just checked.
It's renewing.
Reforming. What?
I thought it's renewing
well,
the energy
to,
vision.
According to, you know, what looks
well, maybe
like.
You're right. Yeah, maybe you're right.
It's
reforming.
Reforming the energy vision.
Okay, thanks.
I took that the words from the PSC public notice that we received. They probably call it a couple of different things.
Maybe they don't know. Okay. Well, this is...
that does sound right, actually, Martha, to what I've...
This reforming is the PSC's the energy, website.
Yeah, okay. Reforming the energy vision.
Yeah. That's funny. They didn't have their own... If
okay.
Carol were here, we'd know.
All right. Are we ready to vote on this?
But I'm sorry. So can we change renewing to reforming in the title and the first whereas?
If it'll make you happy, I don't care. Sure.
Friendly with the mover? Is it friendly with the second?
What goes around comes around.
Who seconded? Martha is friendly with you, obviously. All right. On the motion, on the resolution as amended in the title, all those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
All those opposed, that's unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, Julie?
Actually, I can't remember when our first real meeting is. I'm sorry. I will look it up before we leave tonight.
It'll be February 18th.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll have our first regular meeting on February 18th. Thank you, Kathy. You're always good at that.
Then we'll move on. Charter Review Committee will meet tomorrow, February 6th, at 10 a.m., And we will be discussing the article that has to do with financial procedures and controls. So that's important for the county, and it'll take a little time. So we'll see you there tomorrow. Now, our regular – this has been pushed over like the other committee because of NYSAC conference. And our regular meetings are going to be on Wednesdays at – first Wednesday at 3, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Any questions I can answer? Let's move to Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis is the chair.
Thank you, Michael. We had a meeting at 5:15, and we have a couple of items on the agenda. The first one, and I will move it is Resolution C, a reappropriation of unspent budget allocations for automated external defrib project, and I would move that.
Seconded by Dave McKenna. This is a short. Are you ready? Is there discussion about that?
Let me just say it's a $6,000. It is not new money. It was money that was budgeted a year ago easily.
This will be a short form roll call.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
And he knows. That's unanimous.
Thank you. Resolution D, authorization to participate in various contracts let by any government entity of the United States, America, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley Kiefer.
Short explanation, it allows us to piggyback on the bidding process, i.e., another county wants to do something, they have a big bid, we are able to then go on their bid if that's something that fits appropriately with what we're trying to do. And we do this every year, by the way.
Hopefully that maybe we can put this in as a consolidation of services that we have?
I don't know. We've been doing it since 1881, so I don't know if it works at that point.
Ready to vote. Peter, go ahead.
Isn't that usually called the United States of America?
Only if Dooley sees it. But
it seems to me that that's what I'm
okay, put it, I'm okay with that. Put of in there.
Okay. Are we ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Our next meeting is February 23rd, 4 p.m., right here. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Jim? We'll move on. The old library committee, there's no report. Public Safety Committee, Nathan Shinagawa is the chair.
Yes, the Public Safety Committee meeting will be next Tuesday on February 10th. And so we will be discussing a number of items, but including having a discussion about the body cameras. And so I will be meeting actually with the sheriff tomorrow and be visiting the jail, too, to just get a sense of how things are going as the chair, since it's been a couple of years since I've been a Public Safety Committee member.
Am I right that bids have gone out now or have come back on the jail expansion?
That's correct.
Okay. Yep.
All right. That concludes my report.
Any other questions for Nathan? Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean Claiborne is the chair.
The main part of my report is spoken by the county administrator. That the workplace climate survey, we're about to roll that out on February 9th. You might see these lovely flyers around. Please pay attention and encourage people to do take the survey. It is an online survey to, as much as possible, try to maintain the anonymity of folks and give people that sort of confidence that they can and do this and do it well in their own time as well. It's a two-week window to have this done. On Monday, Paula reminded me, on Monday the 9th also, we will be visited by a client representative from the Kaleidoscope Group who we contracted with for the Workforce Climate Survey. We've had lots of on-phone conference conversations as a committee with them in crafting the survey and understanding who we are as county government and how to work within the parameters of what we have here with our staff. But on Monday, Mitch Brown, who's a client representative from Kaleidoscope, will be here in person visiting with us. And so Paula has set up a meet and greet at 1:15 to 2:30 on Monday in the old jail conference room. And you are all invited. She wanted me to make sure that you knew that you're invited. Department heads and union representatives are also invited to meet and greet with Mitch and to get to share with him as brief as it may be any thoughts that you might have or answer any questions he might have. So you are all invited. And that's my report.
Leslie, could you repeat the date and time of that, please?
Monday, February 9th. 1:15 to 2:30, all jail conference room.
Thank you. Questions for Leslie? Go to Health and Human Services Committee. Peter Stein is the chair.
Yes, we had our first meeting of the year 3 hours ago. Met for an abbreviated session. Our next meeting will take place in March 4th. At 3:30. We passed a couple of resolutions which went onto the consent agenda, and we had an interesting discussion, sort of a variation on something that you heard about a lot, namely a demand for mandate relief. This was a demand of mandate relief not from New York State, but from the United States of America. And in particular, there's an operation called RSVP, which stands for retired seniors volunteer program, where retired seniors who have workforce experience get together and try to do something to pass on that knowledge to the next generation. And they get a grant from the federal government to do this, but every year the reporting requirements get to be so great that they exceed, as near as I can tell, the grant. And as a result, they're having difficulty figuring out how to keep the program alive. And it's a program which I think is widely respected. So I hope that they'll be able to keep it alive. And I hope that if they need some help from us, we'll be able to supply it. That's the end of my report.
Questions for Peter? Will.
Not a really question. Peter, I think I might also point out the topic that came up toward the end of our meeting, which was very animated, that Kathy brought to our attention, which is the measles epidemic and that are happening around, and the problem of people who, for various reasons, have chosen not to vaccinate their children, and what can be done about that. And Frank gave a very, very lengthy, impassioned response. He's deeply concerned about that, and I think you'll be hearing more about that.
Yeah, that seemed to me like an ideal place for the county to get its name in the public area. And I thought that Frank gave such a compelling talk about it that it sounded to me like it would be ideal for an op-ed piece.
Sounds that way to me, too. Jim Dennis.
While I'm not a member of that committee, I was there for this discussion. And what followed, Frank was talking about dealing with school districts. Strangely enough, on the way over here, I looked at IthacaVoice.com, which has an interesting story about the percentage of children in the Ithaca school district who are not vaccinated. And they're one of the lowest of all the school districts in the area. And that's sort of an eye-opening thing. So I thought it was really interesting just reading it now as I walked away from that meeting.
It's the lowest number not vaccinated?
Yeah, the percentage-wise.
Percentage vaccinated is low in the Ithaca district?
82% of the students are vaccinated. Others, it's much higher.
Oh.
So they're running 15 or 16% level that are not, according to this story.
That's crazy. If I'm accurate.
So it's actually worse than the Ithaca City School District. I'm trying to understand what you're saying to us.
It's the Ithaca City School District. Their percentage of people who are vaccinated, but they have the highest number of students who are not vaccinated.
Right. Gotcha.
That's bad.
And if I've done that wrong, please, as long as they get my name spelled right.
Kathy Lou Herrera.
Thank you. As we heard today, and as members of the committee will remember, what is striven, what we go for, is 95%, is that right?
Yes.
And in order to achieve what they call herd immunity, which means that if you have a young person, because of immunity, like a cancer or some other situation where they have a compromised immune system, if somebody that hasn't been vaccinated and has contracted measles comes into a room with that person, or 2 hours later, that person that hasn't been vaccinated due to a compromised immune system should come into the room where someone who, through choice or another reason, has contracted measles, they can get it. It's like more contagious than Ebola. And there's significant scientific evidence supporting vaccination, but we've come to a place in our country where we can't take it for granted that measles has been eradicated due to the non-vaccination of a lot of people. Did I make it more confusing? The part that gets me is that we should have 95% in order for there to be a continuation of people not getting measles. And we don't have that, even here in Tompkins County.
Thank you. Peter?
Yeah, I learned something at that discussion. I frankly never realized why it was so bad in a certain sense, because I thought to myself, well, parents make bad decisions for their children all the time, and the law usually has nothing to say about it. And so it seemed to me that you didn't do any, by not vaccinating your child, you didn't hurt anyone except your own child. And I learned at the meeting that the counter argument is what you just referred to, Kathy, that there are a group of children, I don't know how large the number is, who for some reason or other cannot be vaccinated, or the vaccination doesn't work or something like that. And that's the group of people who is put in danger by you not vaccinating your own children. So I don't know if that's common knowledge, but I had not heard that before. I thought it was interesting.
We'll Thank see. You, Peter. We can move on. Shall we have the minutes of the previous meeting, January 20th, 2015? Someone want to move those? Peter Stein, is there a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Discussion? Ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? I believe that's unanimous. Thank you. Is there a motion to adjourn? Jim Dennis, seconded by Peter Stein. All in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you all. Good meeting, and we've got a great year ahead of us. Well.